Okay, we are up to Perek Yurchet, chapter 18. Last time, we wrapped up chapters 16 and 17, which were the division of the land among Yosef, Ephraim, Menashe, the daughters of Tzlachad, the two sides of the Yarden. And this week, we find out that while we thought we'd been making pretty good headway, right? Reuven and Gad and half of Menashe were taken care of. We took care of Yehuda in chapters 14 and 15. We took care of Ephraim and Menashe in 16 and 17. So we're feeling pretty good. But then we find out there are seven Shvatim to go. Somehow or other, we didn't quite, and Levi doesn't even need. So, how is it that we still have seven left? We do. And we only have two chapters in which to dispose of their property, chapters 18 and 19, Yechet, Yetet. And then after that, it's going to move on. So somehow or other, we have to take care of.
They clearly weren't very problematic.
Yeah, the answer is there isn't a whole lot of adventure in the remaining Shvatim, but there are some interesting notes. Don't think you're going to sleep through the next hour. Today, I hope to get through Perek Yudches, chapter 18, which is, as you see on the sheet, Binyamin. So recognize that means that chapter 19 is going to have six Shvatim, all crammed in. So it begins with a gathering at Shiloh. Why is Shiloh significant? Why are they gathering at Shiloh? What is in Shiloh? The Mishkan, right? The Mishkan is in Shiloh, most famously because of the event where we lose the Mishkan at Shiloh, which is the war in the beginning of Shmuel in the time of Eli, where Hophni and Pinchas take the Aron out to war against the Plishtim, against the Philistines. But yes, they are in fact in Shiloh, and that's where we begin. Pasuk Aleph. Actually, before we start it, let me talk about this to frame the event. I forgot. I need to introduce it a little bit. They're going to be gathered at Shiloh, and that's where they're going to talk about what they do for the remaining seven Shvatim. So the first question is, when exactly does this gathering take place? We know that we've had 7 years of conquest. That was with the wars that we dealt with already last year. And we're taught that just as there are 7 years of conquest, there are 7 years that they spent dividing up the land. So where does this fit into that? So if you take a look at source number one, you get a Gemara in Zvachim. And the Gemara says that this is at the end of the 14 years. Yimei ohel moed sheba midbar arba'im shana chaserachat. The period of the ohel moed, that tent at which they gather when they're in the midbar in the wilderness, that's a 39-year period, or as the Gemara likes to word it, 40 years minus one. Yimei ohal moed sheba Gilgal, and then the period when they are in Gilgal, and Gilgal is the place where they first camp when they cross the Yarden, and they set up the Mishkan. So that's Arba'esrei. That's 14 years. Sheva shechilku v'sheva shechilku. 7 years of conquest and then 7 years of distribution of the land. So that's a 14-year period. Then you may ohal moed shebenov v'givon chamishim b'sheva. The ohal moed, which is at this point we're using the term for the Mishkan, in the cities of Nov and Givon, that's 57 years. Why is the why? What happens in Nov? Why does it move from Nov to Givon? What happens to Nov? Nov is destroyed. Right, that's the city that gives support to David HaMelech. When David is on the run from Shaul, from King Saul, he goes to that city and he tells them, I'm on a mission from Shaul, and you're supposed to give me food, and you're supposed to give me a weapon, and they help him out. And then he goes on his way, and Doeg, one of Shaul's men, finds out about it, and he tells Shaul what has happened, and he advises Shaul to wipe out the city of Nov. And so that's the end of the Mishkan's period in Nov, and then from there it goes to Givon. So it's in Nov and Givon for 57 years. The Gemara's point is not sequential here. The Gemara says Mishkan is 39 years in the wilderness, 14 years in Gilgal. And then it jumps to Nov and Givon and says it's there for 57 years. And what it's trying to do then is to figure out how long was it in Shiloh, because we know the overall period of time, because we're told that they had a Mishkan from the second year in the Midbar until they build the Beis HaMikdash, and we know how many years it is from the time they leave Egypt until they build the Beis HaMikdash, that's recorded. So by extrapolation, or by subtraction, really, you can figure out how long it was in Shiloh. And so the Gemara concludes, Nishtairu l'Shiloh gimel meos v'shivim chaser achas. That means that they were in Shiloh for 369 years. You're going to do the math and check the numbers. Okay, 369 years the Mishkan stands in Shiloh. That's a mind-boggling number. At least for me, that's a mind-boggling number. When you think about what that means, right? 369 years ago was what year? Oh, don't use the calculator. What year? 1646. Right? 1646. Can you imagine a religious site as a center that everybody goes to and they have offerings in daily and so on from 1646 until the year 2015? You know, all the things that have happened, right, in that time, what the world looked like at that point, right? I mean, it's, as an American, 26 years after Plymouth Rock, right? Plymouth Rock is 1620, I think. I'm already forgetting. my kids aren't going to kindergarten plays about Thanksgiving anymore. You took your Canadian citizenship. It's not your fault.
She's allowed to
bring. Yeah. In terms of just like, you know, that's how long they're using this base in Shiloh. And that's where they gather at this point, which is, of course, you know, the beginning of the time in Shiloh. But this is when they gather together in Shiloh. At the end of the 14 years, they're now setting up shop. This is where the Mishkan is going to be, and this is their base of operations and the center for the nation.
How many years was the Beit HaMikdash? Sorry, both Beit
HaMikdash. So we're taught that the first Beit HaMikdash is 410 years. Then a 70-year gap, and then 420 years for the second Beis HaMikdash. There is some confusion relating to missing 165 years or so in the middle that we don't quite know how to account for. But that's the basic number that we have.
So 410 was also more than 370.
Yes, but it's absolutely true. I mean, 410 years is impressive in its own right. But somehow, just the fact that this is so much earlier on, I find to be more impressive, and the fact that it wasn't the Beis HaMikdash. We're going to see in a second what it was. If you take a look at source number two, there is a permanence to it, but it's not the same thing. Amar Rabbi Bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba quotes Rabbi Yochanan with the following question. Kasuv Echad Omer, one pasuk says, V'ativiyehu Beis Hashem, Beis Hashem Shiloh. This is after, remember the beginning of the book of Shmuel, Chana goes to the Mishkan, and she's upset, and she davens, she wants a child, and she then has a child, and that child is Shmuel, and she raises him for a couple of years, and then she brings him to Shiloh, to the Mishkan. And the wording that's used in the pasuk is Beis Hashem, to the house of God. Because of Echad Omer, but then I have another pasuk in Tehillim, which describes Hashem's rejection of Shiloh in the end. And there it says, Vayitosh Mishkan Shiloh, Ohel Shikain Ba'adam. It says that Hashem rejected and abandoned the Mishkan, and it calls it an Ohel, it calls it a tent. Uchsev, and I have another pasuk also in Tehillim, Vayimas Ba'ohel Yosef, Ubeshevet Ephraim Lo Bachar. He rejected the tent of Joseph. And the tribe of Ephraim, he didn't select. We'll talk a little bit more about where Shiloh was and whose portion it was in. But right now what we're saying is that Hashem rejects the Ohel. It's called an Ohel. So is it a house or is it a tent? We associate the word Ohel usually with a tent structure. Curtains draped over something. So, okay, Tzad, the Gemara says, so what exactly was this? Lo haisa sham tikra. There was no roof. El avanim milamatan, there were stones below, meaning stone walls. Virios milamalan, and then curtains above draped over the stone walls. Vihi haisa minucha, and that's what the Torah referred to as minucha, the resting place, meaning in Sefer Devarim, the Jews are told there's a certain way you're conducting yourselves in terms of eating meat and bringing karbanot, bringing offerings, when you're in the midbar, when you're in the wilderness. But once you enter the land and you get to the minucha and the nachala, the rules are going to change on you. Minucha is Shiloh, nachala is Beis HaMikdash. So what the Gemara here is establishing for us is that Shiloh, on the one hand, is not the Beis HaMikdash. It doesn't have a full building. It still has this roof that is curtain rather than an entire building of wood, stone, that sort of thing. On the other hand, it lasts for 369 years, and it is identified as something more than what they had in the wilderness. It's called Menucha. It's not what they had in the Midbar. It's sort of an intermediate step, this site that they have in Shiloh. And that plays out in its legal status. If you take a look at source number 3, you get the Mishnayos in Zevachim, which explain what exactly was the status of the Mishkan in Shiloh. Ad Shilohu kam ha-Mishkan, hayu ha-bamos mutaros. Until the Mishkan was established, private altars, a bama is a private altar. So private altars were permissible. You can have an altar in your backyard where you're going to bring your offering to God. Va'avoda v'bechoros. And the service in the Mishkan was done by the firstborn. Umesha hukam ha-mishkan, once the Mishkan was established, meaning the one in the wilderness, ne'esur ha-bamos, at that point you couldn't have a private altar, v'avoda b'kohanim, and the kohanim were assigned to do the work. And kadshei kadshim ne'achalim lefnim min ha-klayim, v'kadshim kalim b'chol machaneh Yisrael. This requires a little bit of explanation. The karbanot are divided up into two categories. There are kadshei kadshim, high-level karbanot, high-level offerings. Examples of that would be an ola, a burnt offering, where you take the offering after it is slaughtered, the meat of it goes on the altar, on the mizbeach, and the hide goes to the kohanim. That's a burnt offering. A karban chatas, a sin offering, is also on this high level as as kachay kachim, and the part of it that's eaten is only eaten by the kohanim, and it's only eaten, as you'll see, on Har Habayis, the area of the Beis Hamikdash. That's a high level karban. Low level is called kachim kalim, literally lighter level sanctified items, and those are eaten in Yerushalayim as a whole, and they have a lower level. So, for example, a karban toda, if something happens that a person wants to thank God for, so that they bring a thanks offering, that's a lower level karban. A karban pesach is a lower level karban. So, if you want the full list, if you ever look at the part of the Siddur that most people don't, called Ezehu Mekoman, right before Mizmor Shir for the Ashkenazim in the morning, for those who daven Nesach Sfar right before Hodu, you get the Perek of Zachim that lists all the different karbanot and what their status is and where they can be eaten and how they're brought and so on. Very worthwhile read. So, what it's saying here is, when you had a Mishkan in the wilderness, in the Midbar, so kachay kachim, the high level karbanos, the parts of them that were supposed to be eaten were eaten lefnim min haklaim, within the walls of the Mishkan compound. The kachim kalim, the lower level ones, b'chol machane Yisrael, anywhere among the Jews. That's when they're in the Midbar. Bola Gilgal, they get to Gilgal when they enter Israel. Hutru abamos, and at that point, private altars are permissible, because they're starting to scatter throughout the land, and they don't have a central Beis HaMikdash. Kachay kachim le'nechal lefnim ha'klayim, the high-level offerings are still eaten in the Mishkan compound. V'kachim kalim b'chol makom, low-level karbanos, anywhere. Bo le'shiloh, when they arrive in Shiloh, ne'esru ha'bamos. At that point, you're not allowed to have private altars. People aren't able to bring a karban on their own. Shiloh has a certain permanence to it. And as we've already read, there is no roof. It's a stone building with curtains over it. That was, as we've already said, the area called the resting place. High level karbanos had to be eaten within the compound. Kachim kalim, low level offerings, which includes Meiser Sheni, the tithe which is supposed to be brought to Yerushalayim and eaten in Yerushalayim, but they're not in Yerushalayim, they're in Shiloh. Therefore, it may be eaten anywhere. Anywhere it is, anywhere, I'm sorry, not anywhere, Bechol Haroeh. It had to be within eyesight of this Mishkan in Shiloh. In other words, what this is a first quasi-Beis HaMikdash. It establishes a location. You have to be within proximity in order to eat the low-level offerings. Dan?
When the one before, the second paragraph, when they arrived in Gilgal, private altars were permitted within the walls. Walls of what? Because they're private altars.
Right, so high-level offerings being consumed within the walls means those could not be brought on a private altar. Not everything could be brought on a private altar. That's a good point. Thank you. The certain things had to be brought to the Mishkan in Gilgal. Okay. So in Shiloh, you get, for the first time in Israel, the prohibition against private altars altogether. You have a serious building, even if it doesn't have the roof. The rule is that if you want to eat from a korban, either you have to be in the compound, or for some of them, within eyesight of the compound. When this is destroyed, you then get this temporary period when you have Nov and Givon. And that, it continues to say, Bo le Nov and Givon, when they arrive in Nov and Givon, Hutcher Abamos, then private altars are fine. Nov and Givon do not have the status that Shiloh had. Once again, low-level offerings can be eaten anywhere throughout the land. There's no centrality, really, to Nov and Givon. Then you get to Yerushalayim and you have a Beis HaMikdash. Again, private altars are prohibited. Never again will they be allowed to bring their own offering on their own private altar. And that's what the verse calls the portion, the ultimate portion of God that's in Yerushalayim. And at that point, at that point, high-level offerings have to be eaten only within the Beis HaMikdash space, and the Kachim Kalim and Maaser Sheni, the lower level, only within the walls of Yerushalayim. So what I'm trying to establish here and demonstrate with this is that the Mishkan in Shiloh really is a preliminary Beis HaMikdash. It lasts for centuries. It has the stone walls. It is identified in the Torah as Menucha, the place that God is going to rest in, even if it's not the Beis HaMikdash that will be Nachala. It is still something that has significance. When they are there, you're not allowed to have any private altars of your own. You're able to eat karbanos either in that area or within line of sight. So my question to you is, why don't we make more of it? Take a look at the opening sentence of the chapter, which is the establishment of the Mishkan in Shiloh. Vayikahalu kaladas b'nei Yisrael Shiloh. All the Jews gathered to Shiloh. Vayashkinu shemes ohel moed. And they set up the ohel moed there. They moved the tent that had been in Gilgal for 14 years. Right now they move it to Shiloh. V'haaretz nichbasha lifneihem, and the land was conquered before them. And then they continue to say, and there were, seven tribes left who didn't have their land, and this is what we did for the seven tribes. We spent more time talking about everything. Achan's theft from the spoils after the war with Jericho. Two wars with Ai. We spent more time talking about the military strategy Yehoshua devised for the war with Ai. We spent two chapters on crossing the Yarden. We spent so much time talking about the daughters of Tzlacha. Daughters of Tzlacha, they're great, they're wonderful, don't get me wrong. But we spent how many psukim talking about this? Or Achsa's request that the city, that they should get better land because she's been given arid land from her father Kalev. Right, we spend several verses on that. We get one line that says, "Oh, by the way, they moved from Gilgal to Shiloh."
And also, why didn't they make a roof? You're assuming that they don't, that they're thinking it's some permanent place, or at least 300 something years is really quite permanent. So at some point, they could have done that. So
well, you know the way things go.
No, but the point is, somebody knew at some point that this wasn't the permanent. And they're treating it already from day one as if it isn't. So that's the question you're asking, why?
Right. But you know this is the way it happens when you buy a house, right? There are certain things that you say, we're going to do this. And eventually,
one day we'll get around to it. Like Kadosh, if they're not putting effort into it.
Right. So, okay. So
because it's supposed to be temporary.
Right.
Why also Shiloh? They always make a big deal about Har Abai, and that was the place, that God designated, and did they just arbitrarily choose this place, or is there significance to this?
Right. So why Shiloh, we're going to come back to. Bless you. We're going to talk about why Shiloh. It's a good question, and I expect we will get to that today. In terms of the fact that they're treating it as temporary, I think that's exactly the point that they're trying to make here. In other words, the reason why Sefer Yehoshua doesn't spend time on this is, I think, to make a statement. This isn't Hamakom Asher Yivchar. This isn't the place God is going to choose. And I think the reason why it's the place God isn't going to choose is already clear in the Psukim. We have already seen, we've already made reference to it a bunch of times within the book. But we're going to see it over and over again. And that is that even though this pasuk ends with Va'aretz nichbisha lifneihem, the land is conquered before them, the reality is, no, it's not. Right? We've already seen multiple times that they didn't conquer the people they were supposed to conquer. We made reference to it in the previous parak when they said, we don't know what we're going to do. The Kanani and the Prizi are in this area. They don't actually make the conquest that they're supposed to make, and therefore they're not ready for Hamakom Asher Yivchar. They're being stopped short. So effectively what they're doing is building a Mishkan and keeping it temporary and identifying it as temporary, because the goal ultimately is not to be in Shiloh. The goal is to move past Shiloh to Yerushalayim. I think that's the idea. It sort of reminds me of a rule. The Gemara talks about the question of a shul in which grass begins to grow. It's left in disrepair, and grass starts to grow. And the question of whether you're supposed to pick the grass or whether you're supposed to leave it there so that people will see it and be moved by it to do a renovation. To say, we're going to do this properly. In other words, if you're just going to pick the grass here and there, then people are going to say, okay, so this is not so bad. The carpet's 50 years old, fine. And they leave it as is. But what we want is for them to be moved to do something about it. So that may be what we're doing here by leaving it this way. Yeah.
Also, Shiloh is like high, and then there's valleys around it. Right?
Yeah.
So maybe it was like easy for them to be there, because it wasn't as easy for people to take it over, which is why it lasted so long. We were just there last year, actually.
Yeah,
you also went on a tour there, but I'm just trying to think of like the stories that they were telling us there, and the makom and all that kind of thing. So I feel like there's valleys all around it. So sounds like, again, they took a little bit of the easy way out, stayed there for a long time because it was just easy.
Right. So that could very well...
But there are hills in Israel, right? Like...
Yeah, but they were there. So
instead
of, hey, no one's taking it over from us, okay, we'll stay here a little longer.
Possibly. I mean, one thing you have to keep in mind is that the period for which they're in Shiloh, until the time of Eli, is the period of the Shoftim. You don't have kings. There's no real, central authority who's able to speak to all Israel. We find with the Shoftim that they had regions in which they were influential. But that kind of a federal authority doesn't really show up until you get a melech. Now, were they supposed to have a melech? Were they not? Was having a king even a good idea? That's its own discussion for the book of Shmuel. And Shmuel certainly doesn't sound like he thinks it's a good idea. There's a lot to be said regarding that. But I think that the major motivation for staying in Shiloh is simply that you don't have a king who's going to move things from there. In order to do that, you require a king. Certain things have to happen first. The Navi has to authorize the king. David wants to build a Beis HaMikdash, and he's not allowed to. Right? It's not for him to build it. It has to wait. And come to think of it, that may actually tie back into this too. All right. Let's. Why can't David build a Beis HaMikdash?
During the time of war.
So, the psukim themselves are not clear as to why David can't build a Beis HaMikdash. The Tanakh gives us multiple accounts. At one point, it does say, I think I heard Diane say it, that he has blood on his hands from the wars that he has fought. However, that only appears in Shlomo's speech explaining why his father didn't build it, and only in one version of Shlomo's speech, because we have multiple. We have one in Devar HaYamim, we have another one that appears in Malachim Aleph. It's not at all clear why David can't build it, and all the commentators discuss, so what exactly is the real story? Why is it that David isn't able to build it? And if it is about spilling blood, he spilled blood because God told him to. He spilled blood in all these various wars. What blood are we talking about? And there are multiple... Right, so it appears not to be the Bathsheba story, which adds to the confusion, because, you know, if I had to pick something and say, well, that's why, you know, that would have been a good, you know, that would have been as good a reason as any. So the so one approach to it is, and is a prominent approach, is that it's not that David has done something wrong, but David has had to fight wars. That's not what the Beis HaMikdash is for. The Beis HaMikdash is for a time when the wars are done, and so it has to wait for Shlomo. And it's not about the blood of people having been innocent. He was right for doing as he did in the various wars, and this is what he was supposed to do. But you can't do that and build a Beis HaMikdash. It doesn't work that way. Your Beis HaMikdash is for after that. And so I'm now, you know, thinking about that in the context of what we're talking about. Maybe that's, in fact, why they want to keep this temporary, is to demonstrate we haven't yet fought the wars we were supposed to fight. We were brought into this land, as we've said so many times, we were brought into this land because God said the Canaanim have built up such a horribly corrupt society, that can't be. It's entirely inconsistent with having a Beis HaMikdash. It's just not acceptable. You first have to do that, take care of that, then you'll have a Beis HaMikdash. Now, the truth is that David isn't able to fight every war. But we find that the wars settle down by the end of his reign. Shlomo's reign is considered a quiet time. And so at that point, okay, now it's time for a Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. But that may be why Shiloh is really sort of underreported here in the Sefer, is because it's making a statement. It may last 369 years, but it wasn't supposed to be. That isn't what was supposed to happen. It was supposed to be temporary, a stopgap, and you were supposed to then reach Nachala. You were supposed to get to Yerushalayim. Could be.
On the way left for the Israel and the Midbar, the first generation that ends up in the Midbar are Avadim. They have a slave mentality.
Right.
But they're an evil mentality. They don't get to go to Israel. They're a whatever. They don't get to go to Israel.
Yeah.
But that generation cleans itself up. The one that goes in is the sanitized version. I don't feel this anyway, so if anything comes out of
you
correctly, just clean it up in your hand.
Got
you
it.
Get the idea, right?
Yes. Okay, the next generation is the do-over.
Okay.
True. Except for the women who got it right the first time. Correct.
As usual.
Yeah, I mean, there are numerous examples of that in Tanakh, starting in Bereishis. So, if you take a look at this opening, you know, set of two psukim, even the statement that the land was conquered before them, Nichbishalif Nehem, that the land was conquered before them, is a difficult statement because it wasn't conquered. So Rashi says it doesn't mean it was conquered, it means it was ready for capture. But then we get to Pasuk Bet, sentence 2. We've now established the Mishkan in Shiloh, hooray. Vayivasru bivnei Yisrael asher lochol kues nachlasam. What remained among the Jewish people who did not have their shares yet were Shivash Shvatim. Seven tribes. So if the land was conquered, why didn't they divide it yet? So Rashi has already said it wasn't conquered. So Rashi will answer you, that's why, because they haven't fought the wars in these spaces. And that's one approach. Mitzudat David, though, offers a very interesting different angle. If you take a look on your sheet, it's source number 4. He's commenting on Yehoshua's speech to the Jews in Pasuk Gimel in sentence 3, where he's going to tell them it's time to divide it up. And he says that Yehoshua says to the Jews the following, Yadati machshavo seichem. I know what you're thinking, Yehoshua says. Source number 4. He says, I know what you're thinking. The fact that you are not sending people to record the boundaries and to divide it up, because you think that if each one knows his portion, then peni pardu ishmei achiv v'lo yilachem ha'echad ba'avur chelek ha'acher. You're worried about what's going to happen once you divide it up. If Naphtali goes this way, and Dan goes this way, and Zvulun goes this way, right? They've all identified their portions. Then the next thing that's going to happen is tribal identity over national identity. And when each one needs help to settle their area, you're going to say, well, I'm busy with mine. So they actually, as Yahushua presents it, as Mesudat David explains it, what Yahushua is saying is the reason why they have not yet conquered the the reason why they have not yet conquered the land is because they've been stalling. They're thinking that, you know, we have these wars, we've already fought some of the wars, next we'll move on to our area, and everybody will then fight, you know, together on behalf of this land, and then we'll divide it up. After it's already been cleared, then we'll divide it up, which isn't a bad idea, except we know how plans like that go. It drags on, and it's been dragging on for 14 years, and nothing's happened yet, and so Yahushua says, change in plans. We're going to divide everything up, we'll identify the boundaries, and then you're going to have to work on the conquest, and hopefully, yes, you will support each other in doing so. Yeah.
How does that work with them saying 7 years to conquer and 7 years to divide? It sounds like first seven and then seven.
Right. And the answer seems to be, if I take the view that this happened at the end of the 14 years, the second seven were what we read about with Yehuda and Ephraim and Manasseh, and that was their division. And then they're just doing this spot division of the other seven at the end of the 7 years of division.
But then they had all been conquered? Or
no.
Just didn't write that?
They just didn't do it.
But if they were to conquer it and not settle there, then how do you keep it conquered?
Well, theoretically, once you conquer it, you do settle there. In other words, Yehuda's been going and filling his space, and Binyamin's been going and filling his space.
And if they were going to go like one by one by one, were they going to leave people in each place?
Yes.
But then when you get to the end, you have so few people fighting. Who's fighting? Or are just the women and children staying and the men are all going?
Well, it depends on each one. That may be why they didn't actually do it. But theoretically, the way to do it would have been to deploy your forces in different areas and do it systematically.
Right. And then if you're leaving women and children, you used to say someone will come back and...
Correct. So you have to...
take you over because you have no one protecting you.
So you have to be smart about how you do it. The same way they did it with those who are on the eastern side of the Yardin, where Reuven, Gad, and half of Manasseh are told you have to go fight with everybody else, but they leave fortresses there for the women and children who are on the other side, and we presume some people had to stay in order to keep society going there and make sure that they'd be protected from attack, be the warning force, whatever they would be. So maybe that's why it didn't happen, because this requires planning. Mm-hmm. Right, and Jews, we know, are the ones who give organized religion a bad name. For us to actually get this together, to actually divide up and, you know, make this work, is not simple.
So you're saying it's a motivation change? In other words, when you switch over and say, we'll delineate and then conquer, so that people can say, oh, now I'm working for something tangible? Whereas they were, like, less motivated before? Or?
Well, they've been forced on to the next step, is really what it comes down to. Meaning, they were at a step where they could have fought for things and then divided, or divided and then fought. They said, well, we're going to fight for things first and then divide it up. That didn't work. So, okay, so now you'll divide it up. Now you have responsibility for a space. All you people, get out of Shiloh where you've been camping. You're all moving to your land. And now it's going to be your out of Gilgal. And now you're going to be living there, and you have bad neighbors, and you have to figure out how to handle this. And you'll team up with each other, and that's the way that you'll have to do it. It's pushing them, you know, out of the nest, so to speak.
So not everybody has to go to every battle. I mean, could there be simultaneous battles at the same time?
Doesn't
have to
think.
Be sequential battles where we're going to conquer here and there. It might be that you guys go here, you guys go there.
I mean, if you look at the beginning of Shoftim, you find that that's exactly the question. So who's going first? And we're told Yehuda is going to go first. And, like, take a look at the way that plays out. It doesn't play out so well. But that's one of the questions they have to address is, so how are we doing this? But right now, basically, for this chapter and the next, the focus is, okay, let's divide things up. That's what they devote themselves to doing. So take a look at how they're going to divide it up. So Gimel to Zion, sentences 3 to 7. We now have them camped in Shiloh. They have set up the Mishkan. And Yehoshua says to them, Bayomer Yehoshua b'nei Yisrael. Yehoshua said to the Jews, meaning these seven tribes, Adana atem misrapim lavo lareshes asaras shenasam lachem Hashem Elokei Avoseichem. How long are you going to be mitrapim? Rafa means soft. How long are you going to be soft about coming to take this land that Hashem has given to you? Havu lachem shlosha anashim lashavet. Choose three men per tribe. I don't know why three. I looked around. I did not see anyone who explained why three was the number. Take three per tribe. Ve'eshlachem, I'm going to send them out. V'yakumu, they will rise up. V'yishalachu ba'aretz, and they will walk around the land. V'yichtivu osa, lefi nachlasam, they will record it based on their lots. V'yavo'u elayim, they'll come back to me. Yeah, surveyors. Send out surveyors. Three from each shevet, three from each tribe, because this is a political mission. Right? Imagine what's going to happen if you don't have equal representation from each tribe. That's all you need. Right? They come back and, well, they help themselves, they didn't give us what we should get, and so on and so forth. So make sure you have the diplomatic route, three from each tribe.
Maybe that's why there's three.
Maybe. Maybe it reduces the odds of collusion. Maybe it's like you have sort of like a Beit Din of a court from each of the tribes. I don't know, and I haven't seen anybody really provide commentary on the three.
All of them walk around the entire land, or each one walks around their own?
It's not specified here. I would think you want them all walking around it together, because they don't actually know who's getting what.
Oh.
Yeah, they don't know who's getting what yet. Read further. Pasuk Hey, sentence 5. Ve'iz chalaku osa l'shiva chalakim. Divide it up into three portions. Meaning, no, into seven portions, sorry. The meaning not, you know who's getting what, but draw maps that will identify seven portions. Yehuda ya'amod al gvulo minegev. Yehuda will be with his portion in the south, because that's already been assigned. Ubeis Yosef yamdu al gvulo mitzafon. Up in the north you have the house of Yosef, meaning Menashe and Ephraim, because we know about those. Ve'atem tichtavu es ha'aretz shiva chalakim. You will write up the land into seven portions. Va'aveisem elai, and bring it to me. Hey, not here. Ve'arisi lachem goral po lifnei Hashem Elokeinu. I'm curious. How do they translate the word yarisi? Literally, it means to shoot. To cast?
Draw?
We have cast and draw. Okay. But it says, I will cast lots for you. Is that what it says? Okay. And cast, I guess, works. Draw, not so much. But cast makes sense. To, you know, if it's shooting, so it's like you're casting it. Maybe that's the association. I'm asking for a particular reason, which you'll see. But he says, cast for yourselves a lottery here in front of Hashem at this Mishkan that we've established in Shiloh. Ki ein chelek la'leviim b'kir b'chem. Because the Leviim don't count, right? This is why there are seven. The Leviim aren't getting a share among you. Ki chunas Hashem nachalaso. Their portion is the service of God. Reuben and Gad and half of Menashe, they already have their portion. Me'eber le'Yarden Mizracha, on the eastern side of the Yarden. Asher nasan lahem Moshe Eved Hashem, as given to them by Moshe, servant of God. And again, why does he use Moshe's last name? Right, we've seen this before. Yehoshua insists on calling Moshe with his first name Moshe and his last name Eved Hashem. Why is he calling Eved Hashem servant of God?
Authority.
Authority, right. In other words, lest anybody say, well, wait a minute, why did they have the land on the eastern side? And the answer is, because Moshe, servant of God, did it. So if you have any questions, you know, take it up with him, basically. Yes. So that's the charge that Yehoshua gives. Choose surveyors. So his wording that he uses in terms of the lottery is a funny word, yarisi lachem, and it's not the word that we usually use when we talk about a lottery. What word do we usually use? Think about Megillas Esther. Right, he peel a poor. Right, he peel, la peel is also causing something to fall downward, right, from nafal, right? But Malbim says they're actually different words, and there's another word that you need to know, which is a word that you're going to see in Pasuk Ches, and that is lahashlich. Lahashlich is also to throw. So Malbim, remember, Malbim is always focused on differences in wording, differences in language. Malbim wants to know why use one word instead of its synonym. So Malbim generally believes there's no such thing as a synonym. Don't buy into that whole idea. Rather, they have different connotations. So he says in source number 5, Hamashlich lo yechavein el nekuda yidua. He says, a mashlich, someone who casts, as I translated it here, does not aim at a known point. Rak el kol makom sheyipol, sham yeyeh. Wherever it falls, so that's where it's going to be. So imagine, you know, with the Lots, he throws it up in the air and it'll land wherever it'll land. Now, obviously, that's not throwing things into the portions because the portions are far away. But you get the idea is, if he is going to have a goral, he's just going to, a lottery, he's going to throw it at random. V'hamoreh, whereas one who shoots, yechavein l'matara el nekuda yidua. He says that refers to aiming for a known point. Kamo hamoreh b'chitzim, like someone who shoots arrows. Shekoleh l'matara tamid, where he always shoots for the particular target. And so he writes, "Be'emes hayanodali Hoshua beKabbalah chilek kol shevet utchumo eich va'anyipol." He says, "Yehoshua knew by tradition what the portion of each tribe was going to be, and therefore where the lots should go." In other words, he sends them out. He says, "Write up seven portions," and he knows full well which one is going to be Naphtali and Zvulun and so forth. He has that already in his head, but. And he says, how does Yehoshua know it? Shekein Yaakov u'Moshe b'birchasam berchu es kol shevet lefi nachlas artzo. Because go back to the brachas. We asked this question last year. You can find associations between some of the Shvatim and their land based on the brachos that they were given. So, for example, we're told Zvulun l'chof yamim yishkon. Zvulun is going to dwell on the shore. Right? We know where some of them are going to be. So therefore, really, it's Yarisi. I'm going to shoot the lottery, meaning I know already where this is going. It's not as though this is truly random. Well, then why do the lottery at all?
It's dangerous. It's almost like Samantha and Maradman. You're looking for trouble. Everybody wants, they don't know what the portion is.
So, but that's the point of doing it. Exactly. This solves the danger. In other words, the result of doing a lottery is, I didn't decide. If Yehoshua says, I have a book, and the book says in it, you're supposed to be by the sea, and someone else says, well, actually, we were hoping for some beachfront property, so maybe you just did that because you had a deal with Zvulun. He says, uh-uh. There's a lottery, it's all out of my hands, and look, that's where it came out. That's the way it's supposed to be. Much the same way as we had this discussion regarding Achan and why they had to do this with the identification of Achan. You need a certain hands-off procedure, something that will show I didn't tamper with it. And so he's going to do the lottery, but he tells them, we already know which way this is going. Yarisi, what I'm doing is actually aiming at a target that we already know. That's the way the Malbim understands the choice of the word of Yarisi. Keep it in mind, because it's going to matter soon for another thing he's going to say. But he tells them, send three per shevet. And that leads to the question which we discussed back in Perek Yedalet in chapter 14. But because that was before the summer, and therefore, you know, you can't be expected to remember things through the summer. It's not on the final for this year. And because not everyone was here, I wanted to just briefly run through it. I gave you an outline in number 6. The question of how exactly the lottery works, because we have a problem. The Torah itself gave instructions for doing the lottery back in Parashas Pinchas. And on the one hand it said, "Larav tarben achlasov lam atamit achlasov." If you have a larger tribe, give them more land. If you have a smaller tribe, give them less land. And on the other hand it said, "Ach begoral." Only by lottery will the land be divided up. So, I don't understand. If it's done by lottery, you can't guarantee that the large tribe is going to get a larger portion. So why tell them, give the larger portion, a larger tribe, a larger portion. Don't tell them that at all. So, surprise, we have multiple explanations. Rashi's approach here, as is his approach in Parashas Pinchas, as I noted here on the sheet, is that what they're supposed to do is create large and small portions. And then God is going to make sure the right one gets whatever it is. So in other words, you know, because we have a census, you know the sizes of your tribes, you know you need X number of larges, X number of mediums, X number of smalls. And now, you've created that number, and God will make sure with the goral that the right one gets the portion that's appropriate for it. That's Rashi's explanation. I like it. It's simple, it's straightforward, and nobody else agrees. You like the other one? Good. Then you'll be happier. The second school of thought, which has different sort of streams within it, is that now they actually identified equal portions, portions of equal size. Ramban says the way you worked it out was portions of equal size, and then based on the number of families within the Sheva, within the tribe, so the larger families would receive more, the smaller families receive less. When the Torah says, give more to the large, that meant in terms of the families, not in terms of the tribes. That's Ramban's explanation. Radak's explanation is that what you're doing is actually dividing it up into lots of equal size. Those who receive better land, will, or more than they need, had to then compensate the rest. You had to pay them for the fact that you got more, and then the money that the others received could be used to develop their land, could be used to purchase whatever they would then need. That's how you take care of it. And Ralbag says, no. What you're doing is 7 equal portions by Goral, by lottery, and then the way that you manage it is, after you have cast lots, change the boundaries as needed. Right? Do what we did in Chem Lab. Right? That's what you did. You did your experiment, you came up with your results, you realized it didn't match what you needed, and then you changed the boundaries. That's what's supposed to happen. So that's what they're told. That's what Ralbag says they're told to do. First it's by lottery, and then give the one that's larger more, and give the one that's smaller less, and you'll figure it out. That's Ralbag, all within this idea that it's actually equal portions. And then the last approach is Abarbanel. And Abarbanel, also the Malbim quotes this as the view of the Ravid, he says that actually the Goral was just regional. The Goral said, you're going to be in that space, and then it was the job of those surveyors to make that the amount that they needed. I'm not quite sure how that works with the order of the psukim here, because it sounds like they're surveying first and then doing the lottery. So I'm not clear on how Abarbanel does this. But that's his explanation for what's supposed to happen. So what we have here then is Yoshua saying, go out and survey. Either survey making large and small ones as appropriate, or surveying and making 7 equal portions, just that they're in different regions, however you're going to take it. And then and then we'll do a lottery and we'll divide it up.
They weren't equal though at the end, when you look at the map, right?
In the end, they're absolutely not equal.
Those 3 middle sources really, how did they come together?
Right, so that's an interesting question. So what will we do for Ramban? And what will we do for Radak? Ralbag is fine. He says they just change the boundaries as needed. That's an interesting question. What will Ramban and Radak do? Will they disagree with our map? Right, Ramban ends up in Israel. He makes something.
There are different versions of the map, right?
Yeah.
So, I don't know if theirs are all equal in terms of square footage. I don't know. It doesn't look like it, right?
No, it really doesn't. It doesn't look even close. And not only that...
Is it also usable land? Usable
right. Right. So maybe when they say equal, they mean equal arable land, something that you're actually going to be able to make use of. Maybe. It's an interesting question. I don't know. What will they do with the map that we have? Well, take a look at what happens. That's the set of instructions Yoshua announces to the nation. But then we get Pasuk Ches. Vayakumu ha'anashim, vayelechu. So the men got up and went. Vayitzav Yoshua es ha'olachim lichtov es ha'aretz, and Yoshua instructs them to record the land, lemor, saying, lechu v'yishalchu ba'aretz, go walk around the land, v'chisvu osa, and record it, v'shuvu elai, and come back to me, ufo ashlich, you notice the change in wording, ashlich lachem goral lefnei Hashem b'shilo, and then here I'm going to cast the lots for you in Shilo. That's what Yoshua says in this pasuk. Yeah.
Is it them talking, or is this Yoshua talking?
It says, Vayitzav Yoshua. Yoshua is speaking. So that is the question. Well, the first question of two, at any rate, at least two. Why repeat the instructions, and why does he suddenly say Ashlich instead of Yarisi? So, what would you say? Yeah.
Maybe when he said it the first time, they realized that they didn't have as much say, and they complained about it, and went back and said it again, and this time used the word Ashlich. As in, no, it's not all set ahead of time. You have some say.
Interesting. So one way to look at it is he's saying, there is some say, it's going to be Ashlich. The problem that I have with that is that if I take Malim on Ashlich, it actually is more random than Yarisi. It's less... In other words, if he was satisfying them, but if he wanted to satisfy them, he would have said, we'll sit down and work it out together.
No, I thought because here it sounded like I'm deciding.
Uh-huh.
Like, and then he said, no, wait, actually, it'll be a little bit more, the Goral will be more of a Goral.
Right, that's a typical thing. It's not that we want a voice, it's that we don't want you to have a voice.
Yeah.
Well, that's how we spoke to the actual people who were going. First, we just spoke to everybody in general.
Right. But that actually is my other question for Shauna's explanation.
Yeah.
If the people had complained, why doesn't he address this to the nation? Why is he only addressing this to the 21 emissaries who are there with him?
Maybe he wants to caution them to be, say like Sean said, Ashliach, like don't think you have, you can fudge these boundaries or what you're writing because it's going to be, you don't know exactly, like the Yerichi was more exact, this is more...
Maybe. Could be. What else? Well, Mitzudat David says it's simply to be miseries them, to energize them. As in, I gave my instructions to the nation as a whole. But after he gave the instructions, they had some period in which they're selecting people. You know, things sort of get lost in memory, even if it's just a day or two. Nonetheless, it's good to sort of remind them, this is what you have to do. However, Malvim takes a different approach. Take a look at source number 7. And he said, he's going to pick up on Ashlich here. He says, Hagam shel ibnei Yisrael hodia, ki prateya pe'ulos hem mezumanim me'eis Hashem. He says, when Yeshua spoke to the nation, he informed them that the specifics of what's going to happen are all God's plan. Right? Everything is what God said, Yarisi, I'm just going to cast it towards what God already ordained. The whole thing, the whole verdict of what's going where, who's getting it, that's all dictated by God. He says to the surveyors, that's not the way that you're going to do this. I'm not having you divide up the land I'm not having you mark the land with a thought process of, well, God's just taking care of it. You have to take your job seriously, as though God is not managing anything. That's what he is saying to them. He says, I'm telling you, even though I already announced that God has already arranged everything, I want you to go out there and do what people do, which is go out, record things, as though this is fully ashlich, as though this is fully by chance. Don't slack off in your job because, well, God has it under control. Which makes sense, because we've already talked about how they're lax in going out to conquer the land, figuring, well, God has it all taken care of. So Yeshua is telling them, don't make that mistake as you go out on your task. Make sure that you act as though you're actually in charge and responsible. You follow? That's the idea. And then, so he gives them the instructions, and he says, take responsibility. And then, Pasuk Tes, Vayelchu ha'anashim vayavru va'aretz. They went, they traveled through the land, Vayechtevu ha'le'arim, and they recorded it to cities. L'shivach ha'lakim al sefer, in 7 portions, on a scroll, Vayavo el Yehoshua la'machaneh Shiloh. They came to Yehoshua, to the camp in Shiloh. Interesting note, it says they did it to cities. What does that mean? They recorded it to cities. I don't know. I mean, how do your translations render it? You can't use the words, they recorded it to cities, and think anyone understands what that means. According to cities.
Described
by cities. So described by cities is the first one that I actually understand. Meaning that when they identify the borders, they said, well, this is by this city, and this one, go to this city, then hang a left. That actually makes sense.
Because of what they did before.
Right, we use cities as landmarks, exactly.
Well, according to the cities.
Okay. I'm not so sure. I think according to
where the city is situated, that will be your area.
Maybe, but it sounds more like what they're saying is, this area is going to be one lot because it has this number of cities, and this area, in other words, making sure that you actually have populated spaces and livable land for each one is what I would have thought. The question is that part of their job? So Mitzudat David, in source number 8 on your sheet, says, Lefi godel ha'arim. It was based on the size of the cities. Ir gdolam mushtei ayaros ktanos, a large city, opposite two small cities. In other words, what they were trying to do was to assign each of them spaces that would have a certain number of cities each, and if one is larger and another one, you know, others are smaller, then exchanging it, but they were trying to come up with fair portions for each. That's the message of Le'arim. Now, the truth is, as I say it, I'm kind of wondering, is it nicer to give them fewer cities? Mm-hmm. Because fewer cities means fewer inhabitants, otherwise you have more Knanim you're going to have to deal with. So maybe it's the opposite. Maybe they want fewer cities. And that's the exchange that's going on, is to try to give them, you know, manageable portions to take. I'm not sure.
It's the habit of this infrastructure, so they have to do it themselves, if they can conquer it. That's only temporary, right. But long term.
Right. And the answer is, so I can see it either way. I don't know. So to sum up what we've said, we're not going to get through the whole chapter today. Sorry. But to sum up what we've said, I know that comes as a shock, because we always finish what I, you know, expect. But we saw, first of all, the gathering at Shiloh, the creation of the Mishkan in Shiloh, which is going to stand for 369 years as the center of the Jews, with this halachic status of the center of the Jews. You bring a carbon, it has to be there. You can't bring it anywhere else. You want to eat it, it has to be within eyesight of this Mishkan. And yet, it's given this sort of short shrift in the text to emphasize the fact that it is temporary, and my theory is temporary because it's only there as long as you haven't conquered the land. Once you're done with your wars, you'll be able to have a Beis HaMikdash. So I don't want you to see this as your great center in which you're going to endure. Yehoshua instructs them to map the land and to cast lots. I'm going to cast lots. He tells the nation, I'm casting lots in a very... I'm doing it towards goals that we already have identified. We know exactly who is getting what. But then he tells the people, I want you to act as though it's entirely random. We discussed, did a brief recap of how the Goral worked, how the lottery worked, and the problem of large and small portions versus giving everybody based on the lottery. And he instructs them, go out and do this. And as part of it, they try to make it fair and try to exchange the cities according to the what will be fair, so that each tribe has an equal burden or an equal opportunity, depending on how I look at the cities that they had. God willing, next time we will wrap up Binyamin and move into chapter 19.